Chapter 15. Rapture. Aftershock. Retribution. There was something exhilarating about taking kills in this fashion. The many murders that lay at Spears' feet were usually silent, intimate affairs. Just the killer and the victim, together, in a dance that connected them both in a way far more real, far more honest than any other relationship. No one was really naked until the moment of their death. But this... Spear had never killed more than three people at once, because the need had never arisen. Now he was giddy with the blood rush, wondering why he had never done this before. The joy of the frenzy was all-consuming, and it was glorious. Throwing off all pretense at stealth and subterfuge was liberating in its own way. He was being truthful, baring himself for everyone to see, and they ran screaming when they witnessed it. Through the low howl of the sandstorm, the refugees were crying out and scattering. He sprinted after them, hooting with laughter. He had never been so open. Even as a child, he had hidden himself away, afraid of what he was. And then, when the women in gold and silver came for him aboard their black ship, he concealed himself still deeper. Even the men with eyes of metal and glass who had cut upon him, plumbing the depths of his anomalous, deviant mind, even they had not seen this face of him. Spear was a whirling torrent of claws and talons, teeth and horns, the demon skin blurring as it shifted and reformed itself to end the life of each victim in a new and brutal way. Gasping mouths opened up all over him, where vitae spattered his bare flesh, drinking it in. The last of the soldiers was shooting at him, and he felt bursts of burning pain as thick, high-caliber shots impacted his back and legs. The demon skin screeched as it shunted away the majority of the impact force, preventing the rounds from ever penetrating Spear's actual flesh. He spun on his heel, pivoting like a dancer, flipping over through the air. The other soldiers were lying in pools of their own fluids, the sand drinking in their last, where heads had been torn open, hearts crushed. Spear skipped over the soldiers' comrades and ignored the burn of a shot that caressed his face. He came close and angled on one leg, bringing his other foot up in a speeding black arc. Talons flicked out, and the impact point was the man's nasal cavity. Bone splintered with a wet crunch, jagged fragments entering his brain like daggers. How many dead was that? In the race and chase of it, the murderer had lost count. Then he saw the witch hiding her face behind a steel skull, and he didn't care about that anymore. The thin, wiry female shot a fan of needles at him, and he dodged most of them, a handful biting into the demon flesh before the skin puckered and vomited them back out into the dust. This was just a delaying tactic, though. He felt the tremor moving through the warp, the alien monster sheathing his body, shivering and reacting in disgust at the proximity of her. Ill light gathered around the assassin's aura, sucked into the void within her through the fabric of her stealth suit. The wind seemed to die off around the waif, as if she were generating a globe of nothingness that sound itself could not enter. The construct of lenses and spines emerging from the side of the grinning steel skull helm crackled with power, and the perturbed air bowed like water ripples. A black stream of negative energy cascaded from the weapon and seared Spear as he threw up his hands to block it. The impact was immense, and he screamed with a pain unlike any he had ever felt before. The demon skin was actually burning in places, weeping yellowish rivulets of pus where it blistered. All his amusement perished in that second. This was no game. The Psyker girl was more deadly than he had given her credit for. More than just a pariah, she was... She was, in a small way, like him. But where Spear's abilities were inherent to the twisted warp-change structure of his soul, the girl was only a pale copy, a half-measure. She needed the augmentation of the helmet weapon just to come close to his perfection. Spear felt affronted by the idea that something could approach the power of his murder gift through mechanical means. He would kill the girl for her pretense. The demon skin wanted him to fall back, to retreat and take vital moments to heal. He ignored the moaning of it and did the opposite. Spear launched himself at the Psyker, even as he fell into the nimbus of soul-shriveling cold all about her. He immediately felt his own power being dragged out of him, the pain so bright and shining it was as if she were tearing the arteries from his flesh. For a brief moment, Spear realized he was experiencing some degree of what it was like for a Psyker to die at his hand. This must have been what Perrig had felt as she transformed into ashes. He lashed out before the undertow could pull him in. Claws like razors split the air in a shimmering arc and sliced across the armored fabric and the flesh of the waif girl's throat. It was not enough to immediately kill her, but it was enough to open a vein. She clapped a hand to the wound to staunch it, but not quick enough to stop an arc of liquid red jetting into the air. Spear opened his mouth and caught it in the face, laughing again as she stumbled away, choking. Inside Iota's helmet, blood was pooling around her mouth and neck, issuing in streams from her ears, her nostrils. Her vision was swimming in crimson as tiny capillaries burst open inside her eyes and she wept red. The animus speculum worked to recharge itself for a second blast of power. Iota had made a mistake and fired the first discharge too soon, without letting it build to maximum lethality. Her error had been to underestimate the potentiality of this thing. She had no frame of reference for what she was facing. At first thought, she had imagined he was another assassin, sent against her in some power play to undo the works of the execution force. She could not see the logic in such a thing, but then the Clades had often pursued strange vendettas against one another to assuage trivial slights and insults. These things happened, as long as there was no evidence of them, and, more importantly, no ill effects to the greater mission of the Officio Assassinorum. But this killer was something beyond her experience. That much was certain. At the very least, the glancing hit from the Animus's beam should have crippled him. Iota turned the readings of her aura sensor across him, and what she saw there was shocking. Impossibly, his psionic signature was changing, transforming. The sinuous nimbus of ghost colours spilled from the peculiar flesh matter shrouding his body. And, with a sudden leap of understanding, Iota realized she was seeing into a hazy mirror of the warp itself. This being was not one life, but two. And between them, gossamer threads of telepathic energy sewed them both into the inchoate power of the immaterium. Suddenly, she understood how he had been able to resist the Animus blast. The energy, so lethal in the real world, was no more than a drop of water in a vast ocean within the realms of warp space. This killer was connected to the ethereal in a way that she could never be, bleeding out the impact of the blast into the warp, where it could dissipate harmlessly. The shifting aura darkened and became ink black. This Iota had seen before. It was the shape of her own psychic imprint. He was mirroring her. And even as she watched it happen, Iota felt the gravitational drag on her own power as it was drawn inexorably towards the shifting, changing murderer. He was like her, and unlike as well. Where the clever mechanisms of the Animus Speculum sucked in psionic potentiality and returned it as lethal discharge, this man, this freakish aberration, he could do the same alone. It was the blood that let him do it. Her blood, ingested, subsumed, absorbed. Iota screamed. For the first time in her life, she really, truly screamed, knowing the blackest depths of terror. The fires in her mind churned, and she released them. He laughed as they rolled off him and reverberated back across space-time. Iota's mouth filled with ash, and her cries were silenced. The moments seemed to stretch on into infinity. There was no noise across Liberation Plaza. Not even the sound of an indrawn breath. It was as if a sudden vacuum had drawn all energy and emotion from the space. It was the sheer unwillingness to believe what had just occurred that made all of Dagonet pause. In the next second, the brittle instant shattered like glass, and the crowds were in turmoil, the twin floodheads of sorrow and fury breaking open at once. Chaos exploded as the people at the front of the crowd barriers surged forwards and collapsed the metal panels, moving in a slow wave towards the ragged line of shocked Clanner soldiers. Some of the troops had their guns drawn. Others let themselves be swallowed up by the oncoming swell, deadened by the trauma of what they had witnessed. On an impulse the Calidus could not quantify, Coin leapt from the base of the pillar and ran behind the line of crackling force-wall emitters. No one blocked the way. The shock was palpable here, thick in the air like smoke. The hulking Astartes were in a combat wheel around the corpse of their commander, weapons panning right and left, looking for a target. Their discipline was admirable, Coin thought. Lesser beings, ordinary men, would have given in to the anger they had to be feeling without pause. But the Calidus did not doubt that would soon come. One of them shoved another of his number out of the way, tearing off his helmet with a twist of his hand. For a fraction of a second, Coin saw real emotion in the warrior's flinty aspect, pain and anguish so deep that it could only come from a brother, a kinsman. The Astartes had a scarred face, and this close to him, the assassin could see he bore the rank insignia of a brother sergeant of the 13th Company. That seemed wrong. According to intelligence on the Sons of Horus, their Primarch always travelled with an honour guard of officers, a group known as the Mournival.
"Dead," said one of the other Astartes, his voice tense and distant.
"Killed by cowards!"
Coin came as close as the Calidus dared, standing near a pair of worried-looking PDF mages who couldn't decide if they should go to the side of Nykron and the other nobles or wait for the Astartes to give them orders. The sergeant bent down over the corpse and did something Coin could not see. When he stood up once more, he was holding a gauntlet in his hand. But not a gauntlet, no. It was a master-crafted augmetic, a machine replacement for a forearm lost in battle. He had removed it from the corpse, claiming it as a relic.
"But Horus does not..."
"My captain,"
rumbled the sergeant, hefting his bolt gun with a sorrowful nod.
"My captain."
Coin's heart turned to a cold stone in his chest, and movement caught his eye as Governor Nykron pushed away from the rest of the nobles and started down the stairs towards the Astartes. The noise of the crowd was getting louder, and the Calidus had to strain to hear as the sergeant spoke into the vox pickup in the neck ring of his breastplate.
"This is Corda,"
he snarled, his ire building.
"Location is not... Repeat, not secure. We have been fired upon. Brother Captain Sedere has been killed."
Sedere.
The Calidus knew the name, the commander of the 13th Company. But that was impossible. The warrior Kel had shot wore the mantle, the unique robe belonging to the Primarch himself.
"Horus,"
Nykron was calling, tears running down his face as he came closer.
"Oh, for the stars, no. Not the War Master, please."
"Orders,"
said Corda, ignoring the babbling nobleman. Coin could not hear the reply transmitted to the sergeant's earbead, but the shift in set of the Space Marine's jaw told the tale of exactly what had been said. With a jolt of fear, the Calidus turned and broke away, sprinting down the steps towards the crowds. Coin heard the peal of Nykron's voice over the rush of the mob and turned in mid-run. The governor was shaking his hands, racked with sobs in front of the impassive grey-armoured Astartes. His words were lost, but he was doubtless begging or pleading to Corda, vainly making justifications. With a small movement, the warrior raised the barrel of his bolter and shot the governor at point-blank range, blasting his body apart. As one, Corda's men followed his example, turning their guns towards the nobles and executing them. Over the base chatter of bolt fire, the Astartes roared out an order, and it cut through the bedlam like a knife.
"Burn this city!"
he shouted. Somme stumbled through the butchery, clutching the backed gun and dragging the chest behind her. Sinope was with her, trying to support the other end of the container as best she could. The noblewoman's men were all gone. The dust-filled air was heavy with the sound of weapons fire and pain, and there seemed nowhere they could turn that took them away from it. Solm stumbled against a shack, just as a wave of ephemeral terror radiated out and caught her in its wake. The air turned thick and greasy with the spore of psionic discharge. And then she heard Iota's echoing screams amplified through the vocoder of the Culexus's helmet.
"Holy terror,"
whispered the old woman. It could only have been Iota's death cry. No other voice could carry such dreadful emotion in it. Solm turned towards the sound and saw the ending of her happen. Particles of sickly energy were liberated from Iota's twitching body in a rush of light and noise. And then her stealth suit collapsed, the silver steel helmet falling away. Clogged puffs of grey cinders spilled from the black uniform as it crumpled into a heap. The body that had filled it disintegrated in a heartbeat. The skull-faced helmet rolled to a halt, spilling more dark ash into the churning winds.
"Jennica!"
Sinope cried out her name as a shape blurred towards them. The venenum felt a massive impact against her, and she was thrown aside, losing her grip on the chest. She managed to fire two quick bursts from the backed gun as she tumbled, rewarded with the pop and hiss of acid striking flesh. Iota's killer loomed out of the buzzing sands, backlit by the harsh light of the sunrise. She was reaching for a toxin cord as he punched her savagely, disarming her with the force of the blow. The backed gun tumbled away and was lost. Solm felt a jagged slash of pain in her chest as her ribs snapped. Falling to the ground, she tried to retch and found herself in a damp patch of earth, mud formed from sand and spilled arterial blood. A clawed foot swept in and struck her where she had fallen, and another bone snapped. Solm looked up, hearing laughter. The writhing shadow loomed, bending towards her. Then a length of iron pipe came from nowhere and slammed into the killer's spine, drawing an explosive hiss of fury. Solm moved, agony racing through her, trying desperately to retreat. Sinope, her face lit with righteous fury, drew back her improvised weapon and hit him again, the old woman putting every moment of force she could muster into the blow.
"For the God Emperor!"
she bellowed. The killer did not allow her a third strike, however. He arrested the fall of the iron pipe and held it in place, his other hand snapping out to grasp Sinope's thin, bird-like neck and pull her off her feet. With a vicious shove, he twisted his grip on the pipe and used it to run the noblewoman through. Then he discarded her and strode away. He came upon the chest where it had fallen, and Solm gave a weak cry as the murderer's inky liquid flesh streamed into the locking mechanism and broke it open from within. The ancient book fell into the sand, and Solm saw the stasis shell around it sputter out and die.
"No," she croaked. You cannot take it."
The killer crouched and picked up the warrant, flipping through the aged pages with careless speed, the paper fracturing and tearing.
"No,"
he said without turning to her.
"Who is going to stop me?"
He reached the last page and released a booming, hateful laugh. Solm felt a lash of sympathetic pain as he ripped the leaf from the binding of the priceless Eurotas relic and cupped the yellowed vellum in his hand. For a moment, she thought she saw the shimmer of liquid on the page, catching the rays of the sunlight. Then, as if it were some delicacy he was sampling at a banquet, the killer tipped back his head and opened his mouth, his forked jaws opening like an obscene blossom. A dozen more tiny fanged maws opened across his cheeks and neck as he tipped up the paper and swallowed the blood of the God Emperor. He began to scream and howl, and the riot of malformation in his flesh became a storm of writhing fronds, tentacular forms, gnashing mouths. His body lost control over itself, the red-black skin warping and distending into shapes that were nauseating and vile. Weeping in her agony and her failure, Solm dragged herself away towards Tross's skimmer, desperate to flee before the killer's rapture came to its end. Kell was already on his way out, even as the echo of his gunshot died around him. He drew up the camellia-lined cloak across his shoulders, pulling the Exodus long rifle over one arm. He set the timers on the emplaced explosives to ignite once he was clear. The Vindicare paused to add an extra crack charge to a support pillar in the middle of the laundry room. When it detonated, it would collapse the ceiling above and, with luck, obliterate what remained intact of the Hab Tower's gutted upper levels. He had left no trace behind him, but it paid to be thorough. Kell heard the sounds rising up from the streets as he dropped down to the tier below, moving towards his exit point. Disorder would spread like wildfire in the wake of the assassination. The execution force had to get beyond the city perimeter before the pandemonium caught up to them. He went to the edge of the shattered flooring and looked out. He could see people beneath him, the tiny dots of figures running in the avenues. Kell kicked aside a piece of fallen masonry and recovered his descent gear. The Voxlink in his spy mask crackled as the seldom-used general channel was keyed. Kell froze. Only the members of the team knew the frequency, and all of them knew that the channel was a mechanism of last resort. Even though it was heavily encrypted, it lacked the untraceable facility of the burst transmitters. The fact that one of the team was using it now meant something had gone very, very wrong. The next sound he heard was the voice of the Calidus. Every word said was being simultaneously transmitted to Tariel and the Garantine.
"Mission fail,"
said Coyne, panting with the exertion of running. He could hear bolter shots and screaming in the background.
"Confirming, mission fail."
Kell was shaking his head. That could not be true. The last thing he had seen from the Exitus' scope was the flash of radiation as the lance ended the target's life. Horus Lupercal was dead.
"Broken mirror,"
said Coyne.
"I repeat, broken mirror."
The code phrase hit Kell like a physical blow, and he sagged against the crumbling wall. The words had only one meaning. A surrogate, a sacrificial proxy, had replaced their target. A storm of questions rushed through his thoughts. How could Horus have known they would be waiting for them? Had the mission been compromised from the very start? Had they been betrayed? The warrior Kell had placed between his crosshairs could only have been the War Master. Only Horus, the liberator of Dagonet, clad in his mantle, would have made his grand gesture of the single shot into the sky. It could not be true. It could not be. The moment of doubt and uncertainty flared bright and then faded. Now was not the time to dwell on this turn of events. The first, most important directive was to exfiltrate the strike zone and regroup, to re-evaluate. Kell nodded to himself. He would do that, he decided. He would extract his team from this mess and then determine a new course of action. As long as a single Officio Assassinorum operative was still alive, the mission could still be completed. And if along the way a traitor came to light. He shrugged off the thought. First things first. The Vindicare keyed the general channel.
"Acknowledged," he said. "Extraction sites are now to be considered compromised. Proceed to city perimeter and await contact."
Kell secured the long rifle and fixed his descent pack to his back.
"Go dark,"
he ordered, ending the final command with the tap of a switch that deactivated his vox gear. An explosion made his head snap up, and his spy mask's optics located the thermal bloom in the corner of his vision, surrounding it with indicator icons. A vehicle had apparently been blown up by an exchange of gunfire. He wondered who would be foolish enough to shoot back at an Astartes, just as a roar of engine noise swept over his head. Kell shrank into the cover of a partly collapsed wall as a heavy, slate-coloured aircraft thundered around the habitat tower on bright rods of thruster flame. A stormbird in the livery of the Sons of Horus. For a moment, he feared the Astartes had detected his firing hide. But the stormbird swept on and down into the city, passing him by unnoticed. Kell looked up into the early morning sky and saw more raptor shapes falling from the high clouds, trailing streamers of vapor from atmospheric re-entry. Whoever it was that Kell's kill shot had executed, The War Master's warriors were coming in force to avenge him. When he was sure the Stormbird was gone, Kell backed off and then ran at the hole in the wall. He threw himself into the air and felt the rush of the wind as gravity claimed his body. For agonizing seconds, the streets below rose up towards him. Then there was a sharp jerk across his shoulders as the sensors in the descent pack triggered the release of the parafoil across his back. The iridescent curve of ballistic cloth billowed open and his fall slowed. Kell dropped into the sounds of terror and violence, searching for an escape. Every deck of the Vengeful Spirit shook with barely restrained violence as dropship after dropship rocketed off the launch decks. They streamed away from the battleship in a long, unbroken chain, lethal carrion birds wheeling and turning in towards the surface of Dagonet, carrying fury with them. Nearby, system boats in service to the PDF Space Division were either turning to flee from the ships of the War Master's fleet, or else they were already sinking into their homeworld's gravity well as flames crawled down the length of them. The Vengeful Spirit's gunnery crews had been sparing with the use of their mega-laser batteries, striking the ships hard enough to cripple them, but not enough to obliterate them. Now, the PDF cruisers would burn up in the atmosphere, and the fires of their deaths would be seen the whole planet over. It was a most effective way to begin a punishment. The Vengeful Spirit and the rest of her flotilla encroached slowly on Dagonet's orbital space, approaching the staging point where Luke Sedere's vessel, the Thanato, was waiting for them. Most of the Thanato's complement of dropships had already been deployed, the men of the 13th Company falling onto the capital city in a tide of unfettered rage. The handsome and ruthless master of the 13th was beloved of his warriors, and they would avenge him with nothing less than rivers of blood. The tall viewing windows of the Lupercal's court looked out over the bow of the Vengeful Spirit. The curve of Dagonet and the lone Thanato laid out before it. Malaghurst left the War Master where he stood at the windows and crossed the Strategium towards the corridor outside. As he walked, he spoke in low tones to the troop of chapter serfs who followed him everywhere he went. The equerry passed Horus's commands to his underlings, and they in turn moved away to carry those orders about the fleet. Beyond the doorway, there was a shadow.
"Equerry," it said.
"First chaplain,"
Malaghurst replied. His disfigured face turned its perpetual scowl at the word-bearer, dismissing the rest of the serfs with a flick of his clawed hand.
"Do you wish to speak with me, Erebus? I had been told you were engaged in your meditations."
Erebus did not appear to notice the mocking tone Malaghurst placed on his question.
"I was disturbed."
"By what?"
The word-bearer's face split in a thin smile.
"A voice in the darkness."
Before Malaghurst could demand a less obtuse answer, Erebus nodded towards the far end of the chamber, where Horus stood observing the motions of his fleet. The Lord of the Legion was magnificent in his full battle gear. His armor, striped with shining gold and dark brass, hides of great beasts lying off his shoulder in a half-cloak. His face was hidden in the gloom, highlights made barely visible by the cold glow of the data consoles before him.
"I would ask a question of the War Master," said the other Astartes.
Malaghurst did not move.
"You may ask me."
"As you wish."
Erebus's lip curled slightly.
"We are suddenly at battle alert status. It was my understanding we were coming to this world to show the flag in passing and little more."
"You haven't heard?"
Malaghurst feigned surprise, amused that for a change he knew something the word-bearer did not.
"Brother Captain Sedere was given the honour of standing as the War Master's proxy on Dagonet. But there was an incident. A trap, I believe. Sedere was killed."
Erebus's typically insouciant expression shaded dark for a moment.
"How did this happen?"
"That will be determined in due time. For the moment, it is clear that the assurances claiming Dagonet City as a secure location were false. through either subterfuge or inadequacy on the part of Dagonet's ruling Cardas, a son of Horus lost his life down there.
Malachurst inclined his head towards the War Master.
Horus has demanded reciprocity.
The nobles will die, then. The equerry nodded.
To begin with.
Erebus was silent for a few seconds.
Why was Sedere sent?
Are you questioning the orders of the War Master?
I only seek to understand.
Erebus trailed off as Malachurst took a step towards the word-bearer, moving through the doorway and into the corridor.
You would do well, Chaplain, to remember that an honored battle brother was just murdered in cold blood. A decorated Astartes of great esteem whose loss will be keenly felt, not just by the 13th Company, but by the entire Legion.
Erebus's eyes narrowed, showing his doubts at the description of Sedere's great esteem. While it was true the man was a fine warrior, many considered him an outspoken braggart, the word-bearer among them. But as ever, the equerry kept his own opinions to himself. Malachurst continued.
It would be best for the War Master to deal with this matter without the involvement of those from outside the Legion.
He nodded to a servitor in the lee of the doors, and the helots began to slide the towering panels closed.
I'm sure you appreciate that.
There was a moment when the word-bearer seemed as if he were about to protest, but then he nodded.
Of course, said Erebus. I bow to your wisdom, equerry. Who knows the War Master's moods better than you?
He threw a nod and walked away, back into the shadows of the corridor. They were killing everything that moved. The Sons of Horus began by firing on the crowds in Liberation Plaza, routing the civilians and turning the mob into a screaming tide of bodies that trampled each other in a desperate attempt to flee back down the roads and away from the great halls. Coin fought through the mass, catching sight of some of the killings along the way. Kel's emergency command echoed through the vox speed, hidden in the Calidus's ear. The Astartes walked, slow and steady, across the plaza, with their bolters at their hips, firing single shot after single shot into the people. The missile-like bolt shells could not fail to find targets, and for each person they hit and instantly killed, others fell dead or near to it from the shared force of impact. The blasts rippled out through flesh and bone. The crowds were so closely packed together. And although Coin never saw it, the assassin heard the hiss and crackle of a flamer being used. The smell of burned flesh was familiar. The panic was as much a weapon as the guns of the Astartes. People running and pushing, drowning in animal fear. They trampled one another blindly as they tried to escape along the radial streets leading from the plaza. Some transformed their fear into violence, brandishing weapons of their own in vain attempts to cut a path through the madness. Coin rode the terrified mob, as one might have floated on a turbulent sea, not fighting it, letting the frenzied currents of push and pull shove a body here and there. As the roads opened up into wider boulevards, the crush lessened, and people broke into an open run. Some of them were met by strafing fire from the first of the stormbirds that swooped in low between the buildings. The Calidus was carried to the edge of the street and found passage through a storefront damaged in the early days of the insurrection. Hidden for a moment from the screaming throng outside, Coin dared to consult a small hollow map of the city. Any one of the avenues would take the assassin straight out of the metropolis to the city perimeter, but down each street the Astartes were advancing in small groups, coldly pacing their kills into those who ran and those who surrendered alike. After a moment, Coin peered over the lip of a shattered window and saw that the leading edge of the crowds had passed by. Stragglers were still running past, heading southwards. Behind them, walking as if it were nothing more than a morning stroll, the Calidus spotted a single Astartes in grey ceramite, moving with a bolter at his shoulder. Sighting down the weapon as he went, he was picking targets at random and ending them. This was not a military exercise. This was a castigation.
This is your fault!
The voice was full of terror and fury. Coin spun and found a man, his clothes freshly torn and a new cut staining his forehead with blood. He stood across the rubble-strewn shop floor, glaring at the Calidus, pointing a shaky finger. It was the uniform he was indicating, the dun-coloured tunic of the Dagonet Planetary Defence Force, in disarray now, but still a part of the false identity Coyne was operating under. The man shambled through the glass, kicking it aside without a care for the noise he was making.
"You brought them here!"
He stabbed a finger at the street.
"That's not Horus! I don't know what those things are! Why did you let them come to kill us?"
Coyne realised that the man had no idea what had happened. Perhaps he hadn't seen the shield breaker and the lance. All he saw was a monstrous killing machine in armour the colour of storms.
"Stop talking," said Coyne, pulling open the PDF tunic and feeling for a flesh pocket holster.
With a gasp, the Calidus tabbed the seam. Coyne's weapon was in there, but the assassin's muscles were tight with tension, and it was proving difficult to relax and ease the skin matter open.
"Just be silent!"
There was movement outside. Someone on a higher floor in the building across the street, probably some bold member of Capra's rebellion, or just a Dagonetti sick of being a victim, tossed a makeshift firebomb that shattered wetly over the warrior's helmet and right shoulder. The son of Horus halted and swiped at the flames where they licked over the Ceramite, patting them out with the flat of his gauntlet. As Coyne watched, the Astartes was still dotted with little patches of orange flame as he pivoted on his heel and aimed upward. A heavy thunderclap shot rang out, and the bolter blew a divot of brick from the third floor. A body, trailing threads of blood, came spiralling out with it, killed instantly by the proximity of the impact.
They want you,
snarled the man in the shop, oblivious to what was taking place outside.
Maybe they should have you.
No,
Coyne said, fingers at last touching the butt of the pistol nestling inside the false flesh gut over the Calidus's stomach.
I told you to...
Stone crunched into powder. And suddenly the warrior was there in the doorway of the gutted shop, too big to fit through the wood-lined threshold. The emotionless eyes of the fearsome helmet scanned them both, and then the figure advanced, its bolter dropping onto a sling. Coyne stumbled backwards as the son of Horus tore through the splintering remain of the doorway, drawing his combat blade as he came. The knife was the size of a short sword, and the fractal edge gave off a dull gleam. Before the Calidus could react, the Astartes struck out with the pommel and hit the assassin in the chest. Coyne felt bones snap and spun away, landing hard. In a perverse way, the assassin was pleased. Coyne's cover was clearly still intact. If the Astartes had known what he was facing, the kill would have come immediately. The man was pointing and shouting. The son of Horus, having decided to preserve his ammunition for the moment, advanced on the survivor, the top of his helmet knocking light fittings down from the patterned ceiling. A sweep of the combat blade silenced the man by taking his head from his shoulders. The body gave a peculiar little dance as nerves misfired and fell in a heap. Coyne had the gun, but the twitching of the muscles and the flesh pockets would not let it go. Pain from the impact injury robbed the Calidus of the usual concentration and control needed at a moment like this. The son of Horus changed his grip on the knife, holding it by the blade, ready to throw it. In the next second, a crash of bolter fire echoed, and impact points appeared in a line of silver blooms across the chest plate and left shoulder pauldron of the Astartes. Through blurry vision, Coyne saw a man's shape, moving faster than anything human should have, and a face, a mask, a fanged skull made of discoloured gunmetal. Scrambling backwards, the assassin watched as the Garantine sprinted around the Astartes in a tight arc, rolling over fallen counters and leaping from pillar to wall. As he moved, his executor pistol was snarling, spitting out low-gauge bolt shells that clattered and sparked off the towering warrior's armor. The Astartes let the combat blade drop and brought up his bolter. The weapon was of a far larger caliber than the executor. A single direct hit at the ranges these close quarters forced upon the combatants would mean death for the Eversaur, but to kill him, first the Astartes had to hit him. Coyne moaned in pain as the gun slowly eased out of the stress-tensed flesh pocket. Watching as the two combatants tried to end each other. In the confined space of the destroyed store, the bray of bolt shells was deafening, and the air filled with the stench of cordite and the heavy, choking dust from atomized flakboard. A support pillar exploded, raining plaster and wood from the broken flooring above. The Calidus could hear the animalistic panting of the Eversaur as he moved like lightning back and forth across the Space Marine's line of sight, goading the Astartes into firing after him. Stim glands chugged and injectors hissed as the Garantine's bloodstream was flooded with biochemicals and cocktails of drugs that pushed him beyond the speed of even an Astartes' enhanced reflexes. Coin's gun, slick with mucus and fluids, finally vomited itself out of the assassin's stomach and onto the floor. The Calidus clutched at it and released a shot in the direction of the grey armoured hulk. The neural shredder projected a spreading plume of sickly energetic discharge around the son of Horus, and the warrior staggered with the hit, one hand coming up to clutch at his helmet. The Garantine roared past, sprinting over Coin, where the Calidus lay propped up against a wall. "My kill!" he was shouting, the words repeating and coming so fast they became a single stream of noise. "My kill, my kill, my kill, my kill, my kill!" He was a blur of claws and gun, too fast for the eye to process the images. Sparks flew as the Eversaur assassin collided bodily with the Astartes and knocked him down, the Garantine firing his executor into the impact holes in the warrior's chest at point-blank range, clawing wildly at his helmet with the spiked talon of his neuro-gauntlet. Coin could hear the Astartes snarling, angrily fighting back, but the Eversaur was like mercury, slipping through his clumsy armored fingers. Then dark arterial blood spurted as the armor was cracked and the Garantine dug into the meat he found inside. His bolter dry, the Astartes punched and bludgeoned the Eversaur. But if any pain impulses reached the Garantine's mind, the brew of rage enhancers and sense inhibitors swimming through his bloodstream deadened them to nothing. With a croaking, wet rattle, the Astartes sank back and collapsed. Chattering with coarse laughter, the Garantine swept up the fallen combat blade and pressed all his weight behind it. The weapon sank through sparking power cables and myoma muscles until it pierced flesh and cut bone. After a minute or so, the Eversaur dropped to the floor, still shaking with the aftershock of his chemical frenzy.
"So,"
he began, struggling to speak clearly, forcing himself to slow down with each panting gulp of breath.
"This is how it feels to kill one of them."
He grinned widely behind the fanged mask.
"I like it."
The Calidus stood up. "We need to move before more of his brethren arrive."
Aren't you going to... thank me for saving your life, shape-changer."
Without warning, the Astartes suddenly lurched forwards, gauntlet snapping open, savage anger fueling a final surge of killing fury. Coin's neural shredder was at hand, and the assassin fired a full-power discharge into the skull of the son of Horus. The blast disintegrated tissue in an instant wave of brain death. The warrior lurched and fell again. Coin gave the Garantine a sideways look.
"Thank you,"